Just about coming up on 7:30, so I've stopped the share and Alan can load up the deck. I'm going to mute all as usual, and everybody does have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have comment or question, or remute yourself afterwards. Sometime later on this evening, thanks to the hard work of Alan, the contents of the deck, the audio track, and the chat window will be going up on our website. Welcome all to any guests that we have with us tonight. If you want to join the group, I've pasted into the chat the URL where you can go to, or you can just go to our homepage and click on the link near the top for join or renew. It's only $20 a year, and we'd be happy to have anybody join our happy little band. So with that, we've got quite a few agenda items on the slate for tonight, so I will turn it right over to Alan to lead us through the deck.
Okay, so thanks a lot, Chris, and we do have quite a number of topics tonight. Some of them are pretty short, so we'll get right to the meat of the matter. First of all, a follow-up on that issue of KB, whatever it was, the one that needs a bigger recovery script. And if you remember, I volunteered for you all to be the guinea pig. And the reason for that was because, as you see in my maintenance log extract here, I made a full image backup of my hard drive before I did anything with these partitions. And it turned out that was a good idea because, if you remember, I deleted both of the Windows RE partitions that were listed on my system. And Windows booted normally after that. However, when I tried to boot Linux, then it was a different story. I basically got an error message, and Linux would not boot into the regular desktop environment. So rather than play around with various Linux commands to restore things, my pick is always to just recover. Remember, Foxconn will let you do that. It makes backups of individual partitions, and you can choose to select just one of those partitions to recover. So I recovered my Linux partition and basically was back operating normally in just under 4 minutes. And so I highly recommend disk imaging. It works really well and it can be very useful. Okay, Chris also has a follow-up, and this is about PDF files.
Yeah, I think this came, I'm not sure. I think this might have come about in the chat as opposed to something in an actual agenda item. But at any rate, B had this where – actually, this one came in as an email, I think. So at any rate, B sent this in. She got a warning from a friend about a scam that involved PDF files. And I always sort of shudder a little bit when I get well-meaning people forward on scam notifications and things like that, because often they don't really understand the nuances of it, and it can cause an awful lot of alarm when perhaps it's not necessary to do so. But I hate to discourage people from sending in any sort of alerts as well, because it can be important information. So the person described it as being a scammer disguising malware to look like a PDF file and attaching it to emails pretending to be from PayPal. And so I suspect, not having talked to this person, that it could be one of two things. Either it was an actual PDF file that was specially crafted to exploit a vulnerability in Adobe Reader, or it could be an executable that was made to look like a PDF file, specifically by giving it a double file extension, and I'll go into detail on that. It's important to note that the default for Windows is that it hides file extensions for registered file types. So if you get a file that is called invoice.pdf.exe, it will appear as invoice.pdf. We'll go into some detail about that. Next. So it's important also to note that it's not the PDF file itself that's harmful. There's nothing really in and of itself in the PDF file that is going to cause you a problem. What it is the PDF file has been crafted to exploit a vulnerability in Adobe Reader. And I'll explain why it's almost exclusively, specifically Adobe Reader. Next. So if you happen to open up this specially crafted PDF file in Adobe Reader that has not been patched for the vulnerability that this is exploiting, the exploit will be triggered. The attacker could take over your computer or whatever it is that the exploit is designed to actually allow. Next. So this will only be a problem if you're opening a PDF file that is set to trigger a vulnerability and there is an actual vulnerability in Adobe Reader that this is triggering on, and Adobe on your computer has not yet been patched to fix the vulnerability, or you have not updated to a patched version of it. So you could get what's known as a zero day, where Adobe hasn't yet patched it yet. They might not even know about it yet. Or they may have fixed it and you just haven't gotten the fixed version yet. So you look at all that together and you think, well, that's not really likely to be a problem, right? Next. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. So this is a report from last year from SonicWall, a cyber threat report. And they actually reported that 1/5 of all new malicious files out there are actually PDF files. That's huge. You know, it's the only thing that is really bigger than that is executables themselves. So vulnerabilities in Adobe Reader are the primary vector for attack. And why? Next. Here is a Secunia vulnerability review in 1 year going back a few years ago. And they looked at PDF readers. And Adobe Reader, which had an 85% market share in that year, had 43 security vulnerabilities. Boxit Reader, which has an 8% share, had 2 security vulnerabilities, and then we went down to lower market shares and no vulnerabilities at all in them. So next. So if you don't think that yet that Adobe Reader itself is a really, really bad thing to have around, here's a note that came out one time, update now, Adobe fixing 85 flaws in a single update. This wasn't in the year. This was on a single update. The Adobe Reader is the Typhoid Mary of the internet. It's terrible. Now, if you still don't think it was really, really bad software to have on your computer, next. How about this one? Adobe actually put out a patch, and then they had a vulnerability in the patch, and they had to repatch the patch. This is software that you do not want to have on your computer. Now, you need a PDF reader. You don't need Adobe Reader. Any of those other ones that are listed are perfectly fine. Now, I use Foxit Reader, and if you look at it, they have an 8% market share, and they had 2 vulnerabilities that year. So maybe I should actually be switching to one of the others that had no vulnerabilities. I don't think so. And the reason why I don't think so is if I'm an attacker, am I going to go after Foxit Reader and look for a vulnerability, of which there are not too many of them, and if I do find it, I'm going to be able to attack 8% of the people out there, or potentially attack them, or am I going to go after Adobe Reader that has lots of vulnerabilities, I can find a vulnerability in there, and I can exploit it, then I can go after an 85% market share. The bad guys are lazy, and they're smart, so they're going to go after Adobe Reader, they're not going to go after any other reader on the market at all. Next.
Just a note on that, Chris. A lot of people who provide PDFs will often say that you need to have Adobe Reader, and that's not true, of course.
That's right. Yeah, the big thing on that, yeah, the websites will say you need Adobe Reader. You need a PDF reader. You don't need Adobe Reader. Next. So there are lots of other options. So I pasted this into the chat as well. Here are the 5 that are, you know, I came across the 4, or the first 4 are the ones that are listed on the previous slide, and then there's an additional one, Slim PDF Reader, that wasn't in that security review. So any of those other ones will be better to have on your computer than Adobe Reader. Next. So let's also look at the other possibility that you have an executable file that's made to look like a PDF file. Now, this comes out of a presentation I gave on protecting your PC. I've given it 100 times now at the Ottawa Public Library. Continues to be rather popular. and it details how an attacker can make an executable look like a Microsoft Word document. So I just didn't want to redo the slides completely. It'll work exactly the same way with a PDF file. Next. So everybody take a look at this, and you know what type of file is this file? You know, so this is what you may see, a file called budget.doc. And it's got the Word icon. So, yeah, of course, everybody's going to assume it to be a Microsoft Word document. But is it? Next. The default in Windows is to hide file extensions for known file types. So why are we seeing .doc? Because .doc is a registered file type for Microsoft Word document file. So if you're in a default configuration in Windows, you should just see budget. Now, a lot of people might not think too much about why am I seeing .doc? Because you might work on multiple computers, some of them showing file extensions, some of them not showing file extensions, or you know, you're just not that familiar with it, or you just get hung up on the idea that, well, this has got the Word icon, so therefore, you know, it must be a Word document. Next. But if you go on to File Explorer and you go to the View, Show, File Name Extensions, next, then all of a sudden we'll see it as budget.doc.exe. And in the first instance, Windows was doing what it was intended to do. It was hiding the file extension for registered file types. EXE is a registered file type for executable. So it was hiding that by default and just showing you budget.doc. But if you turn on file extensions, and you only have to do it once, and then it'll just stay on, and it'll always work in this manner, what can you tell if you get a file somebody gives you that is called budget.doc.exe? You know two things. First off, you know it's an executable. You know it's a program. It's not a Word document. The second thing you know is with a double file extension, somebody is trying to trick you, as well as having the icon for Microsoft Word for an executable. So it's a really big red flag that this is not a good file that you actually want to double-click on. Next. So a recap on that scam warning. So it came in saying the scammer disguises malware to look like a PDF file and attached it to emails pretending to be from PayPal. Next. So if it was a specially crafted PDF file designed to exploit a vulnerability in Adobe Reader, then the exploit is avoided by not having Adobe Reader installed. You can double-click on it. It'll open up in Foxit Reader or whatever your reader is that you have as a default. The exploit can't exploit it in that particular program because it's not the same program. The same exploit doesn't actually exist in other readers, so you avoid the exploit. Next. What if it was an executable made to look like a PDF file by giving it a double file extension and you happen to be in the default of hide file extensions for registered file types? You change that, and then you'll have the file like invoice.pdf.exe showing up as opposed to it showing up just as invoice.pdf. So the exploit is avoided by having it so that Windows is showing file extensions. So some scam warning that came out that if you're practicing good security on a Windows computer, you would not be vulnerable to that exploit at all. And that's it.
A comment in the chat from Tristan, Chris, most modern browsers can also read PDFs.
Yeah, and I know that Edge was one of the first ones that came out, I think, that could actually read PDFs. And I would tend to avoid them as the PDF reader myself, only because they are going to be a big target as well. So if, you know, the market share for reading PDF files turns out to be 75% Edge, then the bad guys are going to be looking for vulnerabilities in the PDF reader portion of Microsoft Edge and trying to exploit that. So I would still continue to use a standalone PDF reader. Usually you get additional functionality in it as well rather than just what you get in a browser. Currently, I think you're right in that you're better off with that than Adobe Reader, but I think you're even better off with a different standalone PDF reader.
Tom has posted a link to a Reddit article, what is the best PDF viewer? And I just comment on that you sometimes you have to be careful with these best of because they they're not necessarily free and they're not necessarily best. So that's something to think about anyway.
Yeah, Jocelyn says, what happens if you open up a malicious PDF file in another PDF reader? It probably will just display properly because they're not trying to make it that, it crashes Adobe Reader or it doesn't display anything. They're just having it. They want to have it display so you don't know that anything bad is happening, but they have something in the background that is triggering the exploit in Adobe Reader. If you're not in Adobe Reader, it can't trigger any exploit. The exploit just doesn't exist.
And there's a question from Jeff here. He must have done his taxes recently, talking about fillable PDF forms. He uses Adobe Pro, so it's not an issue for him. But he's wondering whether other readers can fill out these smart forms.
In now, most cases, I think so, yeah.
Sorry, personally, I know that PDF Exchange Viewer does. Tom says he uses Sinatra, and it does not. And what about yours, Chris?
Well, I use Foxit Reader, and I have had no problem filling out forms. Also, anybody who is using Adobe Pro, you are vulnerable because most of the exploits that exist in Reader are actually in the code that is in Adobe Pro as well. So keep up to date on your patches if you actually need Pro.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Good summary of all the problems with Adobe. I gave up on Adobe a long time ago because it was updating itself every 3 hours, it seemed.
Okay. One of the first things I do on a new computer is remove Adobe Reader because it often comes pre-installed.
Okay, all right. Next up we have, it's essentially a follow-up, but it's a share from Linda on print services for digital photographs.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So, yeah, I was asked to give my take on it. I'm sure there's lots of people in the club that probably have more experience than me on printing, and certainly everybody seems to have different experiences overall, especially with print companies. But I'll just give you my take on it. So before you print, it's very important to make sure your image is the right exposure. So it might look really bright on your screen, depending on how your monitor's set, but that doesn't mean the image itself is bright and it may print quite dark. So check the histogram of your image, and I've got a link there to an article I did on that a couple of years back, and make sure that you have lots of pixels towards the right side of your histogram so you've got some nice bright areas. Also check for pure white areas because there's not going to be any information, so there's nothing that can be printed there. And it's not usually a problem if there's small areas. It doesn't really bother me. But if you were printing on a colored paper, say, for instance, for whatever reason, then there would be no white there. The color would come through from the paper. Make sure your primary subject at least is sharp, so it will print well, and you can use, you know, any kind of photo editing sharpening tool or AI within your photo editing program if it has it, or sites where you might be willing to pay for AI like HitPA or Photoshop. So use those to make sure you've got sharpness there. And then make sure you have adequate resolution, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. And most importantly, make sure your image is cropped to the desired aspect ratio, the dimension that you want that piece of paper to be in. So if you want a 4x6, probably the image that comes out of your camera is not 4x6. Nor is it 8x10. So make sure you do that cropping. Otherwise, the automatic machine is just going to crop willy-nilly and give you a 4x6, and it may chop off somebody's head or something. So be very careful about that. Okay, next. So all digital cameras and phones have enough resolution right out of camera for a 4x6 or a 5x7. And in fact, most phones these days, you could easily do an 8x10. But older phones, you might want to be careful and not go too much higher than 5x7. The maximum for a lot of printers is 300 dots per inch or 300 pixels. So if you want an 8x10, your length is going to be 300 multiplied by 10, which is 3,000 pixels for your best quality. So if you have a 24 megapixel camera, that's giving you a 4,000 by 6,000 pixel image out of camera. You've got lots of leeway to crop. But check, after you've done your cropping and you home in on that bee on the flower or something, make sure you still have 3,000 or, you know, getting, it could be slightly under, but for your best quality, 3,000 length to have an 8x10. Next. So here's just a quick, a very rough reference. So it's showing the number of megapixels and what is the print size that absolutely guaranteed you'll have no trouble making. And then the OKs are, yeah, you'll probably be okay, but there could be issues. So for 8 megapixels, 5x7, 8x10, you probably could squeak by a few bigger ones, but you might want to be careful. And this is, of course, with no cropping. So that's just a quick reference guide. As I say, you know, even most phones are bigger than 8 megapixels these days, but if you had an old camera, an old point and shoot or something, they might be 8 megapixels. And then if you're going up to billboard size, even 40 megapixels, you're not guaranteed. You're not guaranteed. Okay, next. So another quick guide. So if you had an 8 megapixel camera, the maximum print size you should be 100% sure would be okay would be 8x10, 12 megapixels, 8x14, 16, 11x14, 24, etc. So as I say, you can go beyond that, but there's no guarantee. Next. So what if you decide to print at home? And I have gone down this route. I'm not printing at home anymore, so I might be a little bit out of date. But the first thing you want to do is, before you buy your printer, figure out what is the maximum size that you're going to want to print on. So I, as a landscape photographer, I really like the 8x14 format. I find 8x10 really boxy for a landscape. So I had a printer that was a professional quality printer. It was a very good quality, but and I had the size that I needed to feed in larger paper. So inkjet, far superior to color laser if you want to make photographs, glossy photographs that you want to frame or put on a card or in an album or something like that. I would research the replacement cost for the ink because that's a huge part of your costs. And there's various ways. Some are refillable, some are not. Cartridges, even the refillable ones, I think they get up, gummed up really quickly, especially in a climate like Ottawa where we have our furnaces on all winter, house gets dry, maybe not optimum humidity. And you don't have any option as how to clear these usually, at least I didn't on mine. It had a function to clear them, but it would literally take out almost 20% of my cartridge ink just to do that clearing before I could even start printing an image. And so that was kind of irritating. And the best advice is the one that Chris gave me. He said, well, print one small image each week that uses all the colors. Well, that's great if I remember to do it, but I don't because I don't print that often anymore. So the other route you can go is to calibrate your computer screen to your printer and then print off a small 4x6 just to make sure everything is copacetic and you've got the right amount of brightness. I've never done that myself, but there's an article there you can check out. And then to buy photo paper for printing at home, I recommend you buy paper either designed for the printer brand you have or high-quality third-party paper. You'll never regret spending a little bit more on paper. Next. So there's lots of places out there that will print, and I've only shown a sample of these because except for Vistaprint, I have had experience with the rest of these companies. And so I'll go through them. Photobook Canada, Black, Staples, and Shutterfly have found to be very good quality. Walmart, I have found to be very poor quality, repeatedly poor quality, because I always give companies second and third chances, but I'm done with Walmart. Next. So test the company with single prints. Don't, you know, put in 10 8x10s. You know, put in one or put in one of each size to test the company out and see if you like them. Shutterfly is very good quality, but, and you can register as a Costco member, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. So apparently you can get a better price. They are American prices, but my biggest beef is they have big, delivery fees. And because it's coming from the States, sometimes you get dinged with these handling fees that you'd have to fight with Shutterfly to pay because they're not supposed to have these handling fees on top of the delivery fees. It's not a duty, but it's these sort of handling fees. So that's a bit irritating. And they're in, as I say, US dollars, so you have to remember that. And any of the free shipping sales they have do not apply to Canadian addresses, so you'd have to have a US address. Photo Book Canada is in Canadian dollars, and they're about the same price. Well, Canadian price of around $4, I believe, for 8x10s and things like that. But again, they have significant shipping costs, and I suspect they're shipping from outside Canada too, especially their photo books, because they try and hit you with these handling fees, and I've had Photo Book Canada reimburse me for those. So even though it's Photo Book Canada, it's not necessarily printed in Canada, although probably some of just the 8x10s are. But still, I ordered two or three 8x10s, and it was $12 for shipping, and I found that a lot, considering 8x10s don't weigh a lot. Next. So I've had the best luck with Staples. They have good prices. Especially, you know, if you go online, submit your image, and you're willing to wait 5 days and pick it up at a local outlet, there's absolutely no shipping cost at all. You just wait for them to notify you. You go to the store and you pick it up. So the prices I find very good, and I'm quite happy to wait 5 days. I'm not using that much of a rush to get a print job done. So Walmart, as I say, I've used it a few times because I can walk to Walmart. Quick turnaround, great for that if you're really desperate and under the gun. The 4x6s were okay, but I still would prefer other places. But in a pinch, I'll use them for 4x6. But I'm not happy because recently they've been printing 4x5 and 7/8, and I use them for photo cards, and they sit in an embossed frame, and it doesn't line up right because it's not 4x6. I don't know why it's not 4x6, because that's what it's supposed to be. It's like these 2x4s you buy. But anyway, the other thing I'll mention about Shutterfly is while it has good quality prints, there was a special, and I don't know if they still do it. They'll give you 100 free 4x6 prints if you buy something else. Like, you don't have to buy much. It's just a big promotion. And the prints are horrible. I threw most of them out. I was going to use them for photo cards, and I used them if I wasn't going to charge for the card. But if I was charging for the card at a bazaar or something, then I couldn't use them. So beware of anything where they're giving away free 4x6s. Next. So finally, just think about the surface you want to print on, gloss, matte, luster, whatever, the texture of the paper. You might have a choice. And then are you actually putting your photo on paper, or is it some other media? So you might want to think about colors, et cetera, and how they might show on a fabric or ceramics or something like that. So that's my take on it. So be happy to hear from other people.
We had a question from Karen saying, what about old photos which are now an odd size? What would you recommend on that?
What I would recommend is you either print it on a paper where it fits within. So say you had a 4x6, print it as an 8x10, but make sure you've cropped an 8x10 image with your little 4x6 inside, and then send that in. It will come back, and then you just cut around it whatever frame you want, or you crop it to the new size. But yes, some of the older images are not the same sort of standard size. But you can't just sort of have a 4x6 and put it in, say, oh, I want an 8x10 of this, and I want white around the edges. They're not going to know that. You have to create that background of white, put your little 4x6 inside, order an 8x10 or whatever size, and then cut out exactly what you want.
Yeah, otherwise you're leaving it up to them to decide how they're going to crop it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they'll take a 4x6 and they'll try and force it to an 8x10 because they don't know that you want a border.
I wonder if I just might make a comment. I've been doing photography and graphic design for, way over 30 years. A lot of photography. I would really like to, I like your presentation and what you've said. Bang on, you've got far greater background in a lot of stuff than I have, but I would earnestly suggest that people who want to get into doing a lot of photo processing make sure their monitors are calibrated. Use whatever calibration system you want, but the monitors as they come from the manufacturer are too bright, and you need some sort of calibration software to bring them into reality. That's the best thing you could do and save yourself a lot of money.
Yeah, Linda had a slide about that, and I pasted it into the chat. Calibrating computer screen and printer with a URL to a site. So that's one site, but there's lots of information out on the internet for doing calibration. And typically, you need a piece of hardware to do it.
Yeah, for sure, that is the best route to go. Otherwise, it is hit and miss. And I took the time once, and then I got a new printer or new monitor or something, and I didn't retake the time because I started using print companies. But you're absolutely right that that's for sure the best route to go.
We had a question from Ed.
Have you ever tried Costco for prints, Linda?
Costco doesn't do prints anymore. They've hooked up with Shutterfly. So it's not an option anymore. I never did use it because I wasn't a Costco member at the time. And I became a Costco member, got all excited, but no longer.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that.
Okay.
And moving along, well, Chris has got a share on Chrome or Edge or something.
Yeah, this came as a surprise to me. I came across this just last week. About Edge importing Chrome data. And when you set up Edge, and this can happen periodically where all of a sudden they'll give a new version of Edge and things like that, and they'll take you through the first time you load it where they want you to set it up, or if it's truly the first time you've used it on that computer, they will offer to import your data from Chrome. If they notice that there's a Chrome installation, presumably they will only offer this to you if they notice that Chrome is installed on the computer. Next. And I think this could be convenient. So if you have been using Chrome and you've got all your bookmarks in there and your passwords and things like that saved, you can actually have it that Edge will import all that data. And, you know, this is your choice whether you think that this is a good idea or not. It can certainly save you time. But did you know that Edge is going to continue importing your Chrome data every single time you open Edge? So if you go in, you're using Chrome sometimes, and maybe you bookmark something extra, and then you go into Edge, and it's going to import that bookmark or that password or that other data element that Chrome saves, it's going to import it into Edge. I was rather surprised that it continued to do it. I didn't mind making that choice the first time, deciding, okay, do I want this or do I not want this? But I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it doing it absolutely every time. Next. So if you're not comfortable with that happening on you, you can first off check to see whether Edge is actually doing it on your computer, or if it is doing it, you can actually stop it from doing that. And let me paste in some URLs here. So in the Edge address bar, you just enter in that, and I pasted that into the chat. And next. It'll come up in your settings, and it'll say import browser data, and that's where you can toggle that on or off. So you can see in my particular instance, it was actually toggled off, so that was fine for me. But if you like that happening, then you can toggle it on there. Next. In my investigation on this, I found that there may be an extra step involved as well. There's another settings one about import on launch. And next. This comes up with a more comprehensive dialog box. It's not just an on or off. If you turn it on, you can actually tell it what types of data elements you actually want to import. So either I would suggest go in, and if you don't like them doing it, turn off both of those. If you like the idea of it doing it, come in, and in particular in this second one, take a look at what it can import, and you decide what elements you want imported and what ones you don't want imported. And I think that's all I had on that one.
It is, yes. Thanks very much, Chris. And so next up, we have a question that came in on Shuttle Cloud migration and whether that is a safe app or not. And basically, this is a member who, a friend, had an email account, a non-Google email account. It was getting tons of spam. So they tried everything to get rid of the spam, including trying to get the provider to strengthen the spam filters. But eventually they decided that they would close the 295.ca account and transfer the messages to Gmail. But they weren't using the main Gmail account. And so do doing that, Gmail put all the spam in the spam folder so they could get rid of those very easily. But now they needed to input the useful messages from 295.ca to the main Gmail account. And trying to use the same import feature actually popped up this shuttle cloud migration feature. But then Google then tells you, Gmail then tells you that this process might not be safe. So the question is it safe? Now, personally, I'd never used it. However, Shuttle Cloud is built into Gmail for Gmail to Gmail account transfers. So presumably, if Google installs this thing in their product, you would think it would be okay. But as the member found, you get this warning message that it may not be safe and suggests that you remove access. The thing there is that this is a third-party app. It's not been developed by Google, and this warning is actually just generic. Any third-party app will generate that. So the question really is, if anybody on the call has had experience, good or bad, with Shuttle Cloud, we'd like to know about it. And secondly, is there a better way to transfer messages from one Gmail account to another Gmail account? So if you have any thoughts on that, put something in the chat, or we'll see if we get around to talking about this at the end of the presentation.
Tom had a comment saying that if you use an email reader on your own PC rather than using a web interface, you can get around these sort of problems, but you can still end up with problems, I guess, in terms of having it on multiple computers, and things like that, that web pages certainly give you some nice capabilities for. But for some people, it might be a good solution.
So that's like using a third-party email client.
Yeah, like Thunderbird or something like that. Yeah.
Well, multiple computers, you just use free file sync and keep them as duplicates.
Yeah, but, if I want to access my mail while I'm on vacation in Norway this fall, not so easy.
Yeah, I think this must have just been a webmail transfer, so
yeah.
Maybe they didn't want to go the email client route. Okay, anyway, talking about sharing files, Chris, it's you're up with your part two of sharing files.
Yeah, so this goes back to an article at Windows Intelligence, and the URL has been pasted into the chat, where they listed four options for sharing files, and it was a really well-written article and pretty easy to follow the information along, and I basically just mimicked what they had with some more screenshots than they had and things like that. So on April 17th, we had a Q&A. We had our part one of this where we talked about wirelessly using nearby sharing, which is a feature built into Windows, so there's nothing extra to install. And we also talked about sharing files in the cloud, such as on Google Drive or OneDrive or any of the other cloud services that are available out there. Next. So this week we're going to talk about network cache storage as well as local SAN, which was not listed at Windows Intelligence, but I came across that and I thought it was an interesting enough one that it deserved some attention. Next. And then on May 15th, because we don't have a Q&A next week because it's the main monthly meeting, on May 15th we will have the wrap-up of this, which will be part three on using traditional Windows network file sharing. So a little bit more involved, but personally I think it's one of the most comprehensive and useful ways of sharing files between multiple PCs. Next. So, network attached storage. So it's also referred to as NAS, N-A-S. And what this really comes down to is it's a dedicated device used for storage only that is plugged into the network. And it usually is on a wired connection onto your network. And that's all it's designed to do, is just be able to share files to various devices that are on your network. Next. So it is accessible to all computers on your network, And this can be across Wi-Fi as well as a wired side of the network. It will be discoverable. And optionally, you can actually map a drive letter to the network share, so you can treat it as if it's another drive that is just on your computer. And so you might have it as drive Z. And so anytime you want to access the files that are on this network attached storage, you would just go to drive Z, and it just happens to be a device that is off on the network as opposed to a local storage device. Potentially, NAS devices are set up so that you can access them, the files on them, from the internet. They are, I think, never turned on by default to allow for that. It does require some configuration to that, and I would suggest that don't do that unless you really, really, really know what you're doing, because you typically do not want to expose anything to the internet that has a potential for an attacker coming across and getting access to. Next. One of the big things about network attached storage is that typically they will include RAID, which is redundant array of independent disks, or inexpensive disks, as some people put it. And basically what that is that you have more than one drive, and then you set it up so that you dedicate one or more of these drives such that if you have any drive fail in the array, that it just keeps on humming. And you can, without even shutting down the system, you can you get notified as to which drive has died. You can pop it out on a live system, pop in a replacement drive, and it'll get rebuilt automatically. So that you don't lose any data, you don't lose any downtime. You can even have them where you have a hot standby, where if one drive fails, the hot standby will automatically just start building onto it, and then you can come back and at any point pop out the dead drive, put in a new one, and it'll become the hot standby so that if you have another drive failure, then it'll automatically build onto that new drive that you put on there. So redundancy can be really, really handy for sure. Any mission-critical type things, people really like to have RAID available. Next. You typically will have high performance. So most of them now have, or many of the higher-end ones certainly, will have 2.5 gigabit Ethernet. So if you have a network at home that supports really high speeds, such as 2.5 gigabit, then you can get really high performance between the NAS and all of your devices on the network. Next. And then typically you can get into very high capacity. Usually you will have at least two drives, but there are some instances where you will see things advertised as a NAS device that have a single drive. You don't get redundancy. And typically it's like a bare bones system. Most NAS systems have at least two drives so that you can set them up with a redundancy. You can get up to 8 drive bays or even more, and you can get up to hundreds of terabytes in your total storage. So sky's the limit. Including the price tag. Next. So configuration on NAS devices can get a little tricky. The really low-end ones, probably not a big deal. What they are going to include is a web interface where you can go in, you can slice up things a little bit into different partitions or whatever, and then you can manage permissions to various parts of the NAS, and that's about it. But as you get into more higher-end ones, especially once you get into RAID arrays and things like that, the configuration can get really, really tricky, and there's a lot of jargon that's used. So you very quickly can get into the weeds that it can be a bit of a chore to actually configure a NAS device properly. So there are lots of options, which is a double-edged sword, because lots of options mean that you can configure it in a way that really is optimized for the way that you want to use it, but it adds to that complexity, including the ability to make poor choices. So just be aware of the fact that that can be an issue. Next. And they can be expensive. Next. So here's some examples. Synology is one of the big providers of NAS devices. They have a low-end one that's one bay with no disks for $310 Canadian. And so basically you just choose whatever size disk you want. Again, with a single disk, you don't get redundancy, but you get in with Synology, you will get more configuration options for it, permission settings, and things like that. Next. Western Digital has their MyCloud devices, and they have a couple here that I noticed that a 2-bay with disks, so 2 4-terabyte drives for $435, or you could get a 2-bay with 2 14-terabyte drives for a little over $1,000. So they, being Western Digital, tend to be on the easy configuration side of things, but they're an option that is not terribly expensive. Next. Ugreen is a new entry into the NAS market, and they're up on Kickstarter right now, and you can get a 2-bay to 8-bay. You can choose from various ones, 2-bay, 4-bay, 6-bay, and 8-bay, with no disks. And it runs from about $550 for the 2-bay up to about $2,000 for the 8-bay. And Kickstarter now has it up to 40% off on those ones. So if you are interested in getting into NAS, Ugreen might be a cost-effective way of getting into it. Next. There we go. QNAP. They're another big provider in the NAS world, and so here's an example of one, an 8-bay with no disks at $1,480. And really, you can go up into the many thousands of dollars into NAS devices, so it can get quite expensive quite quickly. Next. So a summary of network-attached storage. I think Alan's got a lag on his system there. There we go. Okay, so the good things about using NAS storage is that it allows you to share lots of files to all the computers that are on your network. And so everybody can store all their files there if they want, and they get the redundancy, you do backup of your NAS device itself, and everybody can access all the same files depending on the permissions that you set and so forth. You can get very high performance access to that data, especially if you get up into 2.5 gigabit and lots of high-speed drives. You do get security through redundancy as well as separation from your computer. So if your computer gets fried, then maybe the NAS keeps on humming away. And you don't need to have all computers on your network in order to be able to access those files, because this is a standalone device that is presumably always turned on. So any computer that is turned on can access the files on the NAS device. On the bad side, it can be tricky to configure, as I mentioned, especially on the higher-end devices, and it can get expensive quite quickly. So that's it for network-attached storage. I don't do it myself, and I don't know an awful lot of the nitty-gritty of configuring NAS devices. I've just seen some of the options, and, yeah, it can get tricky. So next.
Bill says a good NAS is also a great video and audio server.
Yep.
And Tom suggests you can often plug a USB drive into your modem.
Yep.
Or you can create a NAS with an old computer and something like FreeNAS, open source software.
Yeah. What you will lose by having a USB drive plugged into your modem is generally permissions. So if you do that, usually you cannot restrict permissions. Anybody who has access to it has access to all of the files that are on it. There are probably some other ways that you could restrict to certain users, but you start getting into things that it really wasn't designed for that. But certainly, yeah, FreeNAS is software that you can run on a standard computer. So, yeah. Okay.
Okay, thanks. Chris, next.
Okay, this is the one that I think Alan actually came across this, and he said, why don't you cover this? And I said, nah, I'm not interested. And then I actually looked at it, and I thought, actually, this is probably kind of cool. So rather than the other ones, which are built into Windows that I was looking at, this program called LocalSend is a third-party program. But it does allow you to easily transfer files and folders over a Wi-Fi network. So it's not designed to share it over Bluetooth, strictly over the Wi-Fi network. And so it is free and open source, which is always nice. And one of the charms of this one is it's cross-platform. So they have clients available for Windows, macOS, Linux, Android, and iOS. So for me, one of the bugaboos I have is my phone. I find it a little bit of a pain to transfer files from my phone to my Windows computer. I have to plug it in and, you know, various things like that. And I was getting a little bit annoyed by it. And I thought, well, let me take a look at this and I'll see how it goes. Next. So here on the screen, you see on the left-hand side called Big BlackBerry, and the local sign just comes up with these random names for the computers. So it's named my phone, Big BlackBerry, and it's named my desktop on the right-hand side, Fast Cherry. And so there's the interface. Basically, the options are the same on either side. Next. So you set one of them to be sending, and you set the other device to be receiving. And so you can do it either way, but in this case, through the demo, I'm going to actually be showing, or the slides, I'm going to be showing it where the phone is in send mode and the desktop is in receive mode, but it works equally well and pretty much all the same options if you do the reverse. Next. Okay, so I tapped on the left-hand one. I said I wanted to send, and so then it comes up with this screen, and you can see across the top it has file and media and text and folder. And so I want to send some files, so I tap on file. And then you can, if you have subfolders, you can just tap on the subfolder to go drill down. If you want to go up in the hierarchy, you have the breadcrumbs across the top, and you can just click on a previous level on that to move upwards. It will remember the last time you used the program, so it will default to going to that same folder that you used the last time. Next. Once you get to the folder with the files that you're interested in, you can tap on the actual file name to send a single file, or if you want to send multiple files, you tap the icons on the left and you get the little checkboxes. Next. And then in the case of where you decided you wanted multiple files, you have to tap select. If you tap a file name, it just selects it and it will automatically move you back as if you had actually clicked on select as well. Next. And then it brings you back out to this screen, and you can see that it says you've got a selection. In this case, I had two files, and it tells you the overall size, and you can add additional ones. So if you wanted to go to another folder and select some additional files to send all in one batch, you could do that. Next. And then you see the remote computer that is set up in receive mode will show up in the list. Now, one bugaboo that I had happen on me occasionally is that when I go into the program, it wasn't showing the other computer, even though it was set up in receive mode. And I don't highlight it on this one, but just above where the H in cherry, there's a little recycle symbol. And if you get that, that's a refresh. If you get it where it's not showing the other computer, just click that refresh, and a couple of seconds later it should show the remote computer. So when it does show the computer that you want to send the files to, you tap on that. Next. And then on the other side, so in this case here, this is on my Windows computer, and it says that Big BlackBerry is trying to send two files, and I can decline them, or more likely, I tap on accept. Next. And then you'll see the files come in, and it'll tell you that the files have been received, it's finished, and you can click on the done. Notice that the location, it says the destination on there. By default on a Windows computer, it is the downloads directory. In the settings, you can set a different directory or different folder to be the received folder. You don't choose it on a use-by-use basis, it will always go to whatever you've got set up as your default for receiving files. Next. There's another way of dealing with it that I found kind of handy, and that's if you have anywhere in Android where you have a share option. So in this case here, I'm in the photo gallery, and so as I display photos, there is, you know, share, edit, and so forth is along the bottom. Just tap on the share. Next. And then it'll come up with the standard options at the top, sharing to a particular person or through email and things like that. But there are also the apps that are on your phone that are designed to allow you to share. And LocalSend will be on that list once you install it. So you scroll down to where it says Local Share and tap that. Next. And then it comes back with that other screen that we saw before where you can just tap on the remote computer and it will just carry on as it did before of the remote computer having to accept the files and all the rest. Next. So in the settings, there are quite a few settings that are available. The more interesting ones, I think, are the ones listed here. You can set either light or dark theme, or you can have it follow Windows in terms of which it thinks, or Android, which it thinks your default is for light or dark. You can set a language. By default, it will do the default language of the device, but you can actually go in and specify any of about 30 different languages. You can set it up whether you want it to auto-start, in particular in Windows, so that it's always there available for you or not. You can set the destination folder. You can change the device name if you don't want your phone to be called Big BlackBerry or whatever it happens to be called on your configuration, or on my Windows computer where it's called Fast Cherry. I can actually change that to whatever I want. And there are other options as well, but those are the main ones that I thought were kind of interesting. Next.
Do you need to have LocalSend active and running on your PC for this to work?
Yeah, you need the client software running on any device that you want to be able to transfer back and forth. So the LocalSend summary on the good side, free and open source is always a good thing. They do accept donations. It is cross-platform, and that's one of the things that I found to be really, really useful for me. Quite frankly, if I'm doing Windows to Windows, I think there are easier ways than installing an extra application. But if you are doing cross-platform, it can be really handy. It is pretty simple to use. In addition to sending files, you can actually send plain text messages back and forth. So I could see this sort of being useful if you got a big long URL that you want to get over onto another computer. Now, you could email it to yourself and things like that, but you could also just, you know, where it says sending files, you can actually send text message. You could paste it into that and send that over to the other side. You can also send entire folders of files rather than just selecting individual files. And that's one difference between this and nearby sharing, which I covered 2 weeks ago, because nearby sharing doesn't let you actually select folders. You have to select individual files. So in here, you can actually select a folder, and it will send the entire folder and its contents and its subfolders. Next. And on the bad side, it does require third-party software download, but that is free. But you do have to download on each of the devices you want to use. And for Windows to Windows, I think nearby sharing is simpler to use. It's built in. It's always there. And you just have to configure it once and you're good to go. LocalSend is extra software you have to install. And LocalSend must be running on each device where you intend to actually use this. Next. And in 2 weeks, I'm not seeing a new slide.
Alan is frozen.
Hello. Oh, there we go. Okay. So Q&A on May 15th. We will wrap up the series with part three. I'm going to cover off just one topic, and it's going to be fairly involved, but I think it's probably the one that most people will find most useful for doing a lot of file sharing on a Windows network, and that's to use the traditional Windows network file sharing. Next. And I have a call to action. And the call to action for me is, or for you, is there are other options for sharing files between devices. So do you have a method that you use that you find particularly useful that you think, well, the members might want to know about this? You know, if you want to do a share on it, you know, let us know at suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we can slot in some time for you. So this will be at least 3 weeks out from now. Well, we could include it on the 15th, I guess, as well, but it will be at least the 15th. But if you have anything that you could share with your fellow members on how you share files between devices, by all means, let us know. And that's all I've got for today.
Okay. We're going to skip a couple of items, Chris.
My internet is unstable,
and we're almost at 8:30, so
okay.
For this one.
Okay. This is one I came across a long time ago, and I had to save it for today. This Sunday, May 5th, is World Laughter Day. So some of the health benefits of laughter are supposedly producing a sense of well-being, release some endorphins, boost T-cells, improve cardiac health, work your abs, reduce stress hormone levels, lower blood pressure. So this Sunday, May 5th, laugh it up.
Okay, thanks, Chris. All right, we're also going to skip the any questions, and we'll go right to the wrap-up, because as Chris noted, next week is our regular monthly meeting, and we have Adam Hunt, who's an Ottawa resident, basically a Linux expert, but he also does a lot with free software. So he's going to be talking in general terms about free software and in particular the apps that he likes and what these apps can do for you. So that will be next Wednesday at 7:30, which means that we have no QA next week. So you now have 2 weeks to get all your questions and topics that you'd like to share into our suggestion box. And once we have the list, we will make up a new deck for the 15th. So I hope everybody enjoyed the various topics we had tonight. We have two or three which we'll hold over till the 15th. And we'll see you next week at the regular meeting.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you at the general meeting next week.